Good morning. Good morning. So last time we talked about some file system features with regard to making things a little bit better for certain cases. So one of those cases was we had large files. So one of those cases we had large files and we wanted these large files to be represented in a way where we didn't have to have this giant list of blocks. And our solution to that was that we just say, well, here's the starting block, here's how big it is, and we put that in place of our list of single block numbers or our linked list of clusters. And this was called an extent. The disadvantage of this is that now allocating these extents is harder and searching for a particular point in the file is harder because we can't just go to a particular entry in our array of blocks or like list. We have to actually know how big the extents are. Before that, and I probably should have written that here, we talked about fragments, which was solving the alternate problem, which was small files, that we learned that we had some files which were, lots of files which were very small. We had these few large files. And the idea of fragments was that we would sort of split blocks into pieces. For small files, whereas extents are big ranges for large files. So fragments help us deal with small files without making our block size really big, but taking the advantage of the fact that we have typically a lot of small files which are smaller than the typical block size we want to use. We also talked about storing these sort of associated data structures. So one example is we wanted to know, given a byte of the file, where's the data for that, and we had things like extents. Another example is we have directories. We want to know, given a file name, where is that file in the directory? And for both of these, a good data structure is something sorted. We could just have a sorted list, but that's really hard to update. So a common thing to do is have trees, but not binary trees, these sort of fatter search trees, where the idea is that each node of the tree would be a sector or block of the disk, so we could update the whole node together, and the node would have a sorted list of values and pointers to other nodes. And this was an efficient way to store something like a directory, and let us look up a particular file name without having to search through like a list of 10,000 files. And let us add files to the directory without having to insert it in the middle of a list of 10,000 files. And move 5,000 of them somewhere else. Then we talked about redundancy. And we talked about first just having extra copies of data. That our concern was that we're going to lose data because things fail, like parts of disks fail or entire disks fail. So we had one solution for parts of disk failing was, well, for important things, we learned that things like FAT, and it turns out also Unix-style inode-based file systems tend to store extra copies of important metadata. So FAT has multiple copies of that the table itself, and also multiple copies of its boot parameter block, that is its header. Commonly, inode-based file systems will have extra copies of their headers that they call super blocks. And we learned that, well, if you want to do this more, we can just have extra copies of the entire disk. We can just keep two disks and have copies of the data on both of them. And in this way, if one of the disks goes away, well, we still have all our data, and we can copy that data to a new other disk and not have to worry about losing data because of a hardware failure. And then we discussed, well, that's very expensive. We're having twice as much storage as we quote unquote need. So we can have redundancy without extra copies using things like parity, this XOR trick, This is generally called erasure coding. The name comes from the idea that it's a code where we can erase parts of the thing and still have our data. The erasure comes from, for disks, that the disk goes away, or we ask the disk for the data and it says, sorry, I don't have that sector, it got corrupted. And these are things like what we saw for RAID 4 and 5 with parity, are examples of a way of coding the data that deals with part of it being erased and we still have our data. Erase does not there. And I talked about RAID 4 and 5 specifically, mentioned that there's extensions of this which can handle something like losing two disks and other things like that if you want to be fancier, but the math is obviously a lot more tricky. Then we talked about an issue of consistency, that, well, maybe we have our data, but because we got interrupted in the middle of something, our data is inconsistent. That we have a file in our directory, how do we know that we actually finished writing that file versus not? And our key idea here was to order our operations carefully. That was the first idea, and the idea is we don't want to store pointers to bad data. We're still going to have inconsistency, but our inconsistency is going to be things like, I marked a block as used, but I didn't actually use it yet, because I didn't actually make a pointer to it, or I wrote data, but didn't actually make a pointer to it yet. And these are more tolerable kinds of inconsistency than having a file in a directory where we look at its data and it's some junk that doesn't make any sense. And we learned sort of with ordering up operations, we could clean up most, perhaps not all, of the inconsistencies that would happen when we were interrupted by just scanning the entire disk and reconstructing things like what set of blocks are free. Just by looking at what is every block that a file uses, looking through all my millions of files. So that's not fast, but it gets us inconsistency. And the hope is we only do that when we have some sort of problem that where we noticed that we didn't shut down normally, so we might have been interrupted. So any questions about anything we covered last time? Okay, so first a brief note on some anonymous feedback. Some people complained, it's probably a reasonable complaint, that the TAs don't know about using MemMap. So I recommend MemMap for the FAT assignment, but I recognize that our TAs weren't as briefed as they probably should have been on what that looks like. I wasn't too concerned about this, mainly because you are welcome to use Seek and Read, and you can definitely succeed using that, and I know that because Grimshaw's done this essentially the same assignment before without telling anyone about MemMap at any point in the course. And they never used it, and they still did it. So you will succeed doing that. I think MMAP is easier, which is why I have it briefly mentioned in the assignment description. But you might not, especially if you aren't comfortable with pointer arithmetic. And I tried to brief our TAs a little bit, the ones who were at the TA meeting and weren't like interviewing this week or something. So last time we were talking about ordering, as I mentioned. And yeah, I should finish that off by saying that often systems run fhcheck, that file system checker automatically. A common way of doing that is you have like one bit in your header, your super block, saying, is the file system clean? When you boot and start up mounting the file system, you set that to not clean. And when you shut down, after you write everything, then you set it to clean. And this way you know whether or not to run fhcheck on boot. This is a common thing that file systems do. Sometimes they also will do things like say, oh, you've had 90 reboots, we should try running fhcheck again. Some might not do that, and so on. So that's the scanning technique. And this works, it keeps consistency, and it's what people did for a long time. And then there was kind of a shift to a new, better technique. And to understand why it's generally considered better, you need to understand one of the big performance disadvantages of this ordering idea. There's also, before I talk about performance disadvantages, there's kind of a logistical disadvantage. That tracking the order you're supposed to do things is actually pretty annoying. If you think about doing your, you know, you're doing your fat read, you have to like read lots of things. If you're doing the write, you're gonna have all, you'd have like sort of the reverse code, but for writing, where you have to update lots of little places. And in order to track the ordering, you need to organize that in this careful way where you have a list of all the updates you need to do and somehow link them together to make sure you do the ordering right. And well, that's like not that hard to do. It's actually very hard to test. How do you know that you didn't mess up the ordering and you aren't writing one thing before the other that you didn't mean to? How do you like make tests for that? That's tricky. So that's one disadvantage, one reason why people don't like the ordering solution so much, is that it's not that great to code up and make sure that you did it right. But another disadvantage is just performance. And if you remember when we talked about the performance of hard drives, we wanted to order our writes based on the location on the disk. For a hard drive, for an SSD, we're gonna have a bunch of writes we do together, potentially, because we want to write to those erasure blocks. But for a hard drive, this is most notable, we want to write many things in one pass of the disk head. We want to write many things on the one cylinder of the disk in one rotation. And this ordering constraint kind of hurts us there. Oh, so if our idea is that we update the free block map, then the file blocks, then the inode, then the directory, we're kind of shifting around to different locations on the disk. Hopefully these are within a block group, so it's not so bad, but we're still like going back and forth. And we can't just do this in one nice pass of the disk head. Or for an SSD, you might say, well, we're gonna write to the latest erasure block. Now we have to wait for one thing to be written and possibly erasures to be done, then the other, then the next. And we have this extra work, whereas previously maybe the SSD could have cached all our data together, erased a whole block, and written it, and waited until it was more convenient to free up a block of data in the SSD. So these constraints, for disk is most notable, but for all these devices, we're adding these constraints to when we have to have data written, where we have to have data written, that are not going to help our performance. And so we're gonna have this other idea, and we're gonna try to base it on the idea that we want atomic updates, that we don't want our file system update to be in these pieces, part of which can happen, part of which can't, which is what our problem is with ordering, is that we can't just say, make a file, we have to say, set the free block map, and update the inode, and while all those individual things are atomic, because they're sector writes, and the sector is written or not, the whole thing isn't. And we want to make our file system updates be atomic, to be that we update a single sector, and that's what makes the file exist, along with all its blocks being allocated, along with its directory entry being written. And if that sector isn't written, none of that happens. So we want that to be how our file system works. So we're gonna design our file system such that that's the way things work. That there's this one update, which happens or doesn't, and that's what causes our file to exist. If that doesn't happen, our file doesn't exist, including all the things that go along with it, like the directory entry not existing, the free block map updates not being happening, and so on. So we're gonna have that all happen because we write to one place on the disk. And this sort of concept is something commonly known as a transaction. Transaction you can think of as a bunch of updates that happen all at once. And typical implementations of a transaction, the way you do it is you have all your updates together, you know what your updates are, and you have one update which tells you that the transaction happened and one that it didn't. And this is a rule you make for yourself, that You just know that there's some signal that you're going to write down that means the transaction happened or it didn't. If you don't write that down, you're going to make it such that, in how you make the rest of the system work, that it doesn't happen. If it ever does, then you're going to make it happen. And we're going to use an idea called redo logging. So the way that's going to work is that we're going to have, sorry.
So you're saying that like all these updates happen at once, and you're just like tracking one of them to see if all the transactions are done?
Yeah, so a bunch of updates that, I guess I should say, that conceptually happen all at once. Happened, and so we're going to, conceptually, there's one update which is going to trigger this, and we're going to make the rest of our system make that happen. So whole transaction happened, and this means that the rest of system needs to do all updates. And the whole transaction system didn't happen means rest of system needs to hide all updates. So I should have that on the side. So the idea here is that we have this group of updates, and we're going to have this one update, which is kind of our key. And if it happens, we're going to, everything around it is going to make it so all those updates definitely really happen. And if we don't have that sort of key update, we're going to make it so, in the way the rest of our system works, that none of those updates really happen. And the trick we're going to use for this is a lock. So we're going to have something that we write sequentially, where we write down a record of what happens, a ledger, you can say, like that. And so a common way you might do this, and this is something like what XV6, this file system does, we have our super block, we have this area of disk for a log, which is separate from our actual data. And this is, what I'm going to show you here is a common technique for implementing transactions. We're going to have that property that there's this one key update which makes things happen. This is going to be known as redo logging. So we're going to log things that we might want to redo. Where the idea is that in the normal case, we are going to do the things that we write down in the log, and the log is our intention. So this is a log of intended operations that we might need to redo in the case where we have something go wrong. And there's just going to be this one key update which tells us, yes, you need to redo them, or no, you don't. So let's say you want to write a file. So we're going to write to our log, we're going to write some begin record, and we're going to write all the things we need to do to create the file. So we're going to write down that, oh, I need to write the file's data, and I need to write the data for the directory entry for the file, and I need to write the inode for the file, and I need to update the free map for the file. We're going to write down all those things that we're going to need to do, these intended operations, but we're not actually going to update the real place on the disk. So we're writing down our intended operations, and then we're going to write down what we call a commit message. And in the commit message, we're going to say, yes, this really happened. We're committed to making sure it happened. The system is going to make that happen. This is our key update. So you might say, well, that key update happened, but not all of those updates actually did happen. So the rest of our system is going to have to ensure that if we ever see this key update, we are going to make sure that everything that's intended, that's written before it, will happen. That if a failure happens, we're going to look at this log and we're going to say, oh, I committed to doing this operation, so it's going to happen. We're going to redo these operations. So in our normal run, we've committed to doing these operations, and now the data for the file, as far as we're concerned, it's on disk. We have it, we're not gonna forget about it, and we can tell the program, hey, I created your file and it's on disk, you're all set. Even though we haven't actually done our intended updates. And sometime later, after we settle, do some more file updates, when it's convenient, we'll apply these updates to the actual disk. And eventually, all those updates have happened, and we can say, okay, I don't need that log anymore. So the idea is that the log is the first place our updates go. And until we actually do those updates on the quote unquote real place on the disk they are, it's our primary copy of the data. And because we know from one place in the log whether or not we're doing the update, it happens or it doesn't happen. So how does this work with failures? So let me give another way of writing this down. So what we're doing for file creation is first we're writing our intention to this log. The log blocks we want to create, the directory entry, things like the directory inode, the file inode. And then we're writing to log our commit transaction message. And then we're actually updating the data, and sometime later we're going to reclaim that space in the log so we don't just have this infinitely long list of every update we've done to the file system, including creations and deletions, and run out of disk space. So what's going to happen? So let's say we're writing stuff to the log and we have a crash. Our system loses power. Well, in that case, because I didn't write my commit message, our rule is that nothing should have happened. And what we're just going to do is when we reboot, we're going to ignore the log. We're going to ignore this part of the log because there's no commit message. So it's going to be as if nothing happened. Even though we actually started writing the file update, we've organized it in such a way that we can not actually apply any of those updates. Let's say we crash after the commit. In that case, when we reboot, we're going to make this promise that we're going to actually do those updates. So after reboot, we're going to read our log and we're going to say, oh, this is committed. I need to actually do those updates now. I'm going to do that. And so this means the recovery operation is that when we mount a file system, we're going to just read its log. We're going to ignore anything that's not committed in the log. But anything that's commit, we're going to redo. We're going to do those updates again, just in case they aren't done. And then we're going to actually reclaim space in the log. So any questions about this redo logging idea, this idea that we write our intention, and then we write a commitment to doing that, and that's when the operation is done. And then we actually do, at some time that's convenient for us, the updates to the real data, and eventually we can get rid of our intention because we have the real data updated. Questions on? Yes? Yeah, so the commit message doesn't mean we actually done it yet. It's a commitment to do something in the future, in this case. Yeah. So, other questions?
So the only way we keep track is if all things are updated is when we reclaim space.
Yeah, so the only time we actually care about whether the updates have really happened is when we reclaim the space. So this means that when we're mounting our file system, we either need to actually do those updates before we let people read from the disk, or track in memory everything that's in the log. And most commonly, real file systems that work this way are just going to know that if something's in the log that isn't reclaimed yet, I better have a cache copy of that in order to keep my bookkeeping simpler, so I don't have to scan the log every time I read a file. Other questions? So a key thing which makes this work is something known as idempotency, that the logged operations are things that are okay to do twice. And this is a choice, something we have to do when we use this scheme in a file system is we need to choose the things we log are things that are okay to do twice, because it might be the case that we start playing those operations that are in a committed transaction, don't finish it, and when we reboot and read the log to figure out what to do, well, we're gonna do everything again regardless of whether it's been done before. So for example, a good thing to write in our log would be like, set the link count of this inode to 4. A bad thing to write would be increment it. If we set it to 4, we can do that as many times as we like, no problem. If we set increment it, if we do that multiple times, our file system becomes inconsistent. We think we have this extra link to an inode that we don't. But this is actually not too hard. So for example, a simple thing you can do is you can say, I'm gonna overwrite an inode with a new value. I'm gonna overwrite a data block with a new value. And if you overwrite it multiple times with the same new value, you get the same results. So questions about idempotency? So that's redo logging. So it's called redo logging because we redo things that are in the log for recovery. As you might guess, there are also related schemes like undo logging is a thing, which work kind of in the other direction. But redo logging is the most common way of doing this sort of transactions, this idea that we have this bunch of updates to various data in various places, and we make it appear that they happen all at once. That there's one thing which makes them happen, even if we have failures. And I'm showing you this for file systems, but the same principles apply to databases. And databases tend to use the same basic technique. Okay. And a note on names. So file systems that do redo logging or something like it are called journaling file systems, and the log is often called a journal. Just a name. In pretty much any file system you're likely to use on a new computer is a journaling file system. This didn't used to be the case, but probably since like the late 90s, people have switched to just using journaling file systems just because you're a bunch less likely to have your data become inconsistent. And the performance is better, mostly. Okay. And in fact, XP6 comes with a file system which is a journaling file system. And to make things more concrete, let's look about how the XP6 log or journal works. So XP6 has a really simple log. It only holds one transaction, which means that if you want to write a second transaction, you first have to reclaim the space in the log for that one transaction. And it uses a very simple format. So it has a log header, and this is where our commit message is going to be. And it has the actual data. So the log header contains the number of blocks that are in this transaction, the number of things that were updated, and a list of the locations of all the updates, and the rest of the blocks in the log contain the actual updates. And XV6's rule is that they write a non-zero value up there if it's committed, and otherwise, it's zero, and either it's not committed, or there's no transaction in the log. We don't need to treat those any differently when we reboot. If it's not committed, it might as well be no transaction. So initially, we're going to start this at zero. Then When you do some file system operation, like creating a file in XV6, it's going to first write all the change blocks. So some of these blocks will be blocks containing inode, some of these blocks will be blocks containing part of the free map, some of these will be the data, directory entries. They just wrap the function, which writes to a block on disk. So basically they wrote file system code that didn't know about this redo logging and just intercepted all its writes. So instead you write to the log first. And then when you want to commit the transaction, it updates the log header with the locations of all the blocks that were written to the log and the number of blocks. And in XV6, the rule is that's what commits the transaction. Because there's a non-zero number of blocks there, the transaction's committed, and on reboot, XV6 is going to read this and redo those operations. It's going to take each block, it's going to copy it to the location specified in the header, and go. You may note that XV6 isn't writing this log in order, which is not great, so a real system would probably arrange to write this in order for a little better performance, and also because they want more than one transaction anyways, so they can't have one place to look. So after writing this log header, committing the transaction, as far as we're returning to the program, we're done. If we return from the open call, we say, yep, we created your file, and it's definitely going to be there. But we still have work to do, so we need to write the data. And this is the part which is going to be redone if we need to do it on recovery. And after all the data is written, we just clear the log header, we set it to zero, and now we're ready for the next transaction. That's reclaiming our log space. So this makes sense. This is the super simple scheme. We're missing pieces like maybe we want to do multiple transactions, maybe we want to do something smarter than write out a whole copy of a block of inodes. But this definitely works, and it's not actually hard to implement. It's not hard to retrofit existing code to use this, because basically you just look at every place it writes to the disk and make it write to this log instead. And you don't need to do any funny formatting, it's just blocks. So one question we have to answer is, well, what is a transaction? Is each file update a transaction? Is each delete a transaction? Is each write a transaction? So XV6 has this particular solution to this, and that's based on the idea that, well, it's faster to do a bunch of updates together, and this redo logging makes that easy, that we can write as much stuff as we have space for in our log. So it doesn't each need to be that we log one create and write a commit message, log another create and write a commit message. If we have 1,000 files being created, we can just log all of them, and at some point we decide, okay, this is a good time to commit, I'll commit now. And this is what XV6 does. So XV6 says if you're doing multiple file writes at the same time, it's going to just combine them into one transaction. So we'll have one transaction where instead of updating the blocks for just one file, we're updating the blocks for 2 or 3 or 10 files. And that's fine. We're still going to redo all those updates if it's committed. And that means that we have one write, which instead of just writing, one file now writes 100 files as far as making them available for the application to say, yes, it's really written on disk. So this idea makes sense. Okay, so let's talk about two little issues with redo logging. So one is about keeping the log size. So I mentioned we can reclaim data in the log. So that's something we need to care about doing. And one thing we need to worry about is, well, this takes some time. How big can the log get? And an unfortunate fact about this is that if, like, you're concerned about writing a lot, this is kind of expensive because we might need to sometimes wait to free up log space. The hope is that usually, and this is probably true in practice, usually we write to the log and we're not writing to our disk all the time or reading from our disk all the time. So there's some free time during which the OS can actually do the updates, and you basically don't notice. It's basically free. So we just write to the log once, and the rest of the updates happen in time where we wouldn't be using the disk anyways, or the SSD, so we don't actually care about it from a performance point of view. But if things get bad, you might have to wait for the log to have extra space in order to actually do something the program wants us to do. So another issue is that we're writing everything twice. That we have to write our file data to the log, and then we have to write it to the actual place on disk. And that seems like a problem. Now, and you might say, this means probably this is really expensive. In practice, journaling file systems are often faster. So can someone tell me what the reason for that is? Why would it be faster, even though we're writing everything twice? First, we're writing it to the log, then to the real place on disk. Yeah? Yes, because we schedule the disk more efficiently. In particular, our log can be easily is trivial to write sequentially. And all the other updates we can do in any order. So we get to make more efficient use of the disk. Applications never wait for real files. And as a concrete example, think about updating 1,000 files. So you're like, you update 1,000 files. With redo logging, we basically have two big seeks. We have one seek to the log to write the records for the 1,000 files we're going to update, and another seek to go to the places on the disk where those 1,000 files are and write them in the order they appear on the disk, even though we have like directory entries in one place and the file data in the other. Whereas if we do our careful ordering thing, unless we figure out some way to like combine multiple file creations together with our careful ordering, we're going to be writing to the free block map, seeking to the inode, seeking to the directory entry, seeking to the next directory entry, next inode, next directory entry, next inode, and we're going to have a lot more moving around, and it often ends up being slower. But even though there's this performance benefit of journaling, it still can be bad to be writing things twice, especially when we're thinking about big files. Because writing 100 meg, well, it's not the seek time you're worried about, it's the fact that you're writing 100 meg like takes a second. And if you have to write it twice, well, you're taking at least 2 seconds. And for this reason, some journaling file systems make a compromise. They decide, well, what I really care about is that the file system is consistent, that the directories make sense, that the file names make sense, but I'm going to hope the data just works out. Or I'm going to hope that, when you ask me to write the data, I've written it to that one place, but I'm not going to write an extra copy of the data and have that be done in sync with all the other file system updates. That the file system data is going to be written separately, and it might get out of sync on a crash with the rest of the file system. So this is less good from the perspective of keeping your data, intact and consistent, but it does save that double writing while giving you a lot of the benefit of journaling with a lot less writing to the log. If you think about if we aren't writing the file data to the log, how much stuff we have to write, it's very tiny, even if we're updating 1,000 files. So for this reason, this is a common choice, even though it seems not great from a sort of data integrity perspective. So, any questions about sort of redo logging and journaling file systems? Yeah?
Could redo logging that duplicates everything, some metadata and user data, could that put SSD availability?
So the question is this not great for the amount of writes in SSDs? Probably. It's probably not a huge effect because it's only twice as much writing. And where the SSD durability hurts you is if for some reason you don't spread out your writes over the entire SSD with current SSDs. It used to be that SSDs were kind of cutting it close on the number of times you could write it, but I think that's less common these days. I'm not sure, I'm not an expert on that, but that's my impression, is that as they've gotten better, they've not been getting to a point where you're likely to run into the write limit because they're spreading out the writes over all the chips. But there are solutions, there are other ways of avoiding writing the data twice some of the time, which can help, which we probably won't talk about for time reasons. Okay, so I'd like to talk about another idea of data integrity. This is about backups. So if you're a system administrator, usually the biggest problem you have is not that something fails and someone lost data, it's that someone accidentally deleted something and they lost data. And there's this really clever file system solution to this called snapshots. And the idea is that the file system keeps backups, that it keeps old versions of the entire file system around. And that means that if you have do an accident deletion, you can go back to one of these old versions, get the file from it, and eventually you'll get rid of them, you know, when they're too old. But this is sort of automatic backup, and that's online. It's a really convenient feature. It happens that the department file systems implement this. And there's this relatively simple implementation technique. It's pretty elegant for this, which is copy on write. Which is that when we make a change to a file, rather than actually editing the inode and such, we're gonna make a new location for all the things that we changed. We're gonna copy on write the file, and we'll have a pointer to the old one in our snapshot, pointer to the new one in our current version, and when we get rid of some pointers to something, we'll actually delete it from the disk. It's the same kind of idea that you did for copy and write with paging. And just like with, you know, fork, we can share the common parts between the versions. So if we only modify the end of a file, all the blocks for the beginning of the file can be the same between the versions. So this doesn't actually take up that much disk space, even though we have copies of our file system as it was yesterday, the day before, 2 days before. You know, that's not gonna take up 3 or 4 or 10 times as much space. It's only gonna take up the space we need for the extra files, changed files. So the way this works is we have our inode. If you remember, if in an inode-based file system, we usually have like some direct blocks of data, some indirect blocks down here. I probably should have put this marker, this indirect block marker down here. So these are our indirect blocks here. So we have an indirect block and a double indirect block here, pointers to our file data. And when we do an update, rather than changing those blocks, what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, you're editing the end of the file. I'm going to create a new inode, which points to a new indirect block, which points to those change blocks. Points to new copies of blocks for where you have the changes. So I just made a copy of everything you changed with the changes. Anything that stayed the same, I'm still pointing to. So all the stuff that stayed the same, it's unchanged, and we have two pointers to it now instead of just one. Obviously, there's some bookkeeping here. We need to keep track of, oh, I have two pointers to all these blocks, so I need to make sure I don't delete them or reuse them too early. OK, Okay, so we have this new inode, and we also want to update our inode array. So we have our inodes in this big array, and we should just make a new copy of the inode array. So that's something we could do, is we could say, we updated the inode array, let's make a new copy of it for our new snapshot. But that's pretty expensive because we have a lot of inodes, and they're stored in this land big array on disk. So there's a solution to this, which is, as with most problems we've seen, is just more indirection to deal with how do we store our new inode without making a copy of the entire inode array, which is like all the million files on this disk. And the solution for that is we split our inode array into pieces, and we're only going to update this piece with the old inode. So this is, you know, update this piece to make snapshot with the new version of the inode. And in order to find these pieces, we'll have a scheme similar to free files for the inode array. And our textbook calls this a root inode with some indirect blocks to point to the pieces of the inode array, because it's often like millions of inodes. And the idea is our copy on write, we're going to make copies of that parts of that structure that we need to, that we've changed. And that's not going to be very much for only updating one file. And we still share all the unchanged parts, just like we did for the file update. So questions on this? So we're doing this copy and write scheme. We're making a new version of just the parts we need, and we make sure that things are split up with these pointers, such that we can just change little pieces to update a particular file or particular blocks in a file. So this is efficient at having two versions of the file stored in our two different snapshots. And the idea is that we have some array here, and this we say is the, you know, old snapshot. And this here is the, you know, new snapshot. And we just have some interface where we can set, the user can say, I want to access the old snapshot and this file. And we just go to the root inode that was the old one. And if you want to access the new one, we just go to that one, depending on what version of the file system you're asking to access. And just have an array of these. And those are, you know, snapshots, array of versions of the file system. So questions on this scheme? So obviously I'm skipping a lot of details, like we need to track how many pointers there are to everything here. So the bookkeeping is a bunch more complicated. And so I showed you this, so we'll have an array of root inodes for the, you know, snapshot versions. So that's copy and write. So it's a relatively simple idea. We just make a new copy. We can have this array of versions of the entire file system we call snapshots. And we're just changing pointers, but only the pointers to things which change, so we share most of our data. And as I said, department machines implement this. So for example, if you go to the root of a file system, there's this .zfs directory, which has a snapshots directory. And you can go to a directory for the way our department has configured it. For every 6 hours, you can get a copy of the file system going back, you know, like a month or so. So if you delete a file, you can go into there, you have a lab account, and see the old version of the file and copy it out. Questions? Okay, so that's everything I'm going to talk about for reliability. So I have a couple other miscellaneous file system topics, and then we'll start talking about distributed systems. So one other file system topic is about mounting. So those of you who for the FAT assignment has used the mount command, not the mount function, but the actual mount command in the command line. Okay, so like order half of you-ish. So what that did is it made that file system image appear as a directory. And this is the way that Unix does things. It's a common approach. And it has this nice property that since it appears in this directory, and it's really, it just looks like it could have been a directory, and it's indistinguishable. So for example, this here is a file system, and I can use dot dot. The file OS makes that work, even though we can't actually have a directory entry dot dot that points to another file system on that file, on a disk, the way we've talked about directory entry formats. And it's pretty common that you'll have lots of file systems mounted. So let me give an example from a department machine. So this is the output of the mount command. I'm not showing all of it because it's actually way longer than this. So we have here, we have a saying that slash, the root of the file system, is an extended for file system mounted read-write and set to remount as read-only if something bad happens. And it has the device file dev sda1. We also have slash local temp, which is another extended for file system, which is dev sda3, is this device. So those are the normal entries here. And we have a bunch of weird ones. So we have, this is not a file, device file, something in slash proc, which is a proc file system. And if you look in that file system has directories for every process which is running on your machine. So that's obviously a file system that's not actually data on disk, but they've decided that we're going to use the file system interface to provide you other information. And that's what slash proc is. Similarly, we have this slash dev file system, which is this dev tempfs. And the idea is that they decided, well, we're not going to actually store these device file directory entries on a real disk. We're just going to make a special file system that shows you that, and that stores them in memory. And similarly, we have slash run here, and it's type tempfs. So tempfs is a file system that Linux has where instead of storing the data on disk, it just keeps it in memory, and if you shut down, well, it's gone. So that's a directory of files which are, well, you can put files there, but they'll go away after reboot, but it's in memory, so it's really fast. Doesn't go to disk. So we can have all these different file systems mounted. We also have down here these network file systems. So NFS stands for network file system. And this mount point is saying that there's a machine called ZFS1 where this file system comes from, and it's a remote file system that we're viewing locally as if it were a local directory. So to support all these different file systems together, in this one common infrastructure, we need to have some sort of API for the kernel to let you implement a file system that works very differently. We have this proc file system where it's not really files on disk. We have this tempfs where we don't store things on disk. We have this network file system where we have to contact another machine. But they have this common interface that they implement. And in Linux, this is called the virtual file system API. And in Linux, It's an object-oriented interface, which is based heavily on the FFS, the fast file system, the standard inode-based file system design. So if you implement a file system, you create sort of object implementations for your soup, for something called a super block, which represents your header, something called an inode, which represents a file, something called a dentry, which represents a cache directory entry, just the name, basically, and the inode pointer, and something called a file, which represents an open file as opposed to a possibly unopened file or a directory. And you implement these interfaces, and the idea is that this is really easy if you're implementing an inode-based file system, maybe a bit harder if you aren't. And there's common code which handles all sorts of tasks that everyone needs to do, like directory traversal. If you're writing a file system on Linux, you never write the code which handles dot and dot dot. Someone else writes that for you. You never write the code which handles slashes. Someone else writes that for you. You never write the code which handles file descriptors. Someone else writes that for you. Just write, how do you read from a file? How do you open a file? And so on. So each of these sort of objects has different operations. So superblock has a write inode, sync the file system. Inode has all the directory operations, like create a file in this directory, link, unlink, make dir, has open to set up an open file, directory entries, you have a comparison function in case your file system's case insensitive. But there's the basic idea is we have this big set of operations you implement, and this means that everyone can just implement their own file system with this upon this interface and have it mounted together. And sometimes this is a little awkward. So example, if you think of FAT. FAT doesn't really have inodes, but if you want to, as someone actually did, of course, make a FAT file system for Linux, well, it needs an inode object, sorry. Because that's what the interface is. So you kind of need to, so they need to do something where they like kind of pretend there's an inode, but it's actually like a directory entry, and they need to make the interface work despite it being different. So our questions about file system interface. Main reason for showing you this is just to give you an idea of what sort of the OS level interface for a file system can look like. So questions? So that's all I'm going to have on file systems for today. So we're going to talk about distributed systems as our next topic. And the idea of a distributed system is that we have multiple machines working together to perform a single task. And we're going to use this term really broadly, perhaps more broadly than some other people would use. And we're going to say that, like web browser, web server, we'll call that a distributed system, even though some people might say, no, it's not. And there are different ways of organizing these things, and we're going to mostly focus on the one above the line, which is the client-server model. There's some kind of centralized thing, which is special, called a server, which communicates with clients. Clients never communicate with each other. They only communicate with the server. But there are other models, like the classic example is just that it's a free-for-all, everyone can talk to everyone. Peer-to-peer model, everyone's equal, which is another way things could work. We're going to focus on the client-server model, at least to start. Partly because it's the most common, that it turns out that implementing the peer-to-peer model is pretty impractical in many cases, and partly because it's easier to do implement than anything interesting in the peer-to-peer space. I'm an assignment implementing a server, which will be an example of that. So let's talk about the client-server model. So the way this works is that we have a client, and the client is a machine which is sometimes old. So the client sends requests to the server, so it needs to know how to contact the server, and it's only working when it's sending a request to the server. It's not necessarily available at any other time. The server is always there. It's always ready to respond to client requests. And the way it communicates with clients is by responding to requests. It doesn't communicate unbidden. It never initiates contact. It just gets requests from the client, sends back a response. That's when the server acts. So the server doesn't know who its clients are except at the point in time at which it gets requests from the clients or and needs to talk to them. So questions on client and server? Okay. And this is in contrast to peer-to-peer, where typically there's no single server one knows about, and that has the advantage that with our server model, well, if the server breaks, we're in trouble. If the server is slow, we're in trouble. With the peer-to-peer model, maybe we can do better than that. And where any machine can contact any other machine, and maybe even the set of machines changes over time. So, given our basic model, so first let's talk about what we want to accomplish with, you know, having multiple machines. Why don't we just do everything on one machine? So, the biggest things are functional reasons that, well, we have to collaborate. You know, we're not going to do that on one machine because I'm not physically in front of your machine, you're not physically in front of my machine. So we need something where multiple machines cooperate. Another thing is I want to delegate responsibilities to someone else that, you know, I don't want to manage backing up my files, I want someone else to do that, and that means I have to somehow use their machine. You know, or give them access to my machine, and we're having multiple machines involved, we have a distributed system to do that. There are also, however, reasons which are not so functional why people want to have systems composed of multiple machines. So one example is that maybe it's more efficient, that you can take many cheap machines and achieve the same effect as if we had a really, really expensive machine. So back in the 90s and the dot-com days, it was common for startups to buy like a multiple $100,000 machine to run their web server, which is not something we'd ever think of doing today. Today we just spread out our web servers across multiple machines, you know, that have a more of a distributed system in order to save costs. It's easier to add to incrementally. If you didn't like your $200,000 box from Sun and you wanted to get the $500,000 box, well, that upgrade path isn't so hot, great. You're replacing a very expensive thing, whereas if we have these cheap components, we can just add components incrementally as we our needs make us do that. And another big potential benefit is that we may have more reliability. If we have three machines doing something, if we can make it so one of those machines can stop working, we'll have redundancy and we can get things done more often. And that's another reason why people might have a distributed system. Is that, for example, you might have a copy of your website in America, Europe, and Asia, so you know that though one of them should be still available no matter what happens. So a common goal whenever we're doing distributed system stuff, which will come up later, is transparency. That things will look like it wasn't distributed, that everything is like local, that it should be the same interface, and that's just like a better single node system. That's a goal. That's not going to happen. But that's typically when we're designing interfaces for distributed systems, that's typically what we want things to look like, is that it's kind of like you're doing something locally, it just and we don't have to care about that there's a network in between and so on. But we're not going to be able to achieve that because there's a bunch of places where we're going to have to deal with naming other machines failing, that wouldn't happen on a single node. But it's a common goal that users won't notice, where users might be programmers, for example, won't notice that the system is distributed and that they maybe could rely on the system figuring out what machines to use, how to handle failures, and so on. And when you're building a higher level distributed system, like, you know, something you use from a web browser, this is a goal that maybe is achievable and definitely one you have, that you don't want people using your website to know how many web servers are there backing this. That's not something they should need to know about or have any way of finding out if they're using your website normally. Okay. Yes?
So like you said, the common goal is transparency, but don't most websites like keep it transparent?
Don't most websites keep it?
Like if you're like going like hands-on or something.
Yeah, so the question is, do websites provide this transparency? So when things work, basically yes, is that besides the fact you know it's a website, they basically, you don't know like if they have a big database backing, like multiple machines backing things or not, so it acts like one system to you. You still notice some artifacts of it being distributed, most notably, like if Amazon's server is down and your machine isn't, you sure notice. If your network has problems, you sure notice. It's not like it's running on your local machine. That's sort of an example of where transparency is broken and we can't really do anything about it. Another example of where transparency might be broken is that the way websites like that are complicated and built out of these multiple machines like Amazon's fail is often one component of the website will fail. So you look at Amazon.com and suddenly you don't have, you know, your recommendations list because that server isn't working right now. And that's sort of an artifact where you're noticing that there's a problem within Amazon's infrastructure that wouldn't happen if it was just a single node in your machine. Okay. So let's stop talking about really high-level stuff and go to talking about communication. So we want to build these nice, transparent, distributed systems. What's our way of thinking about how we communicate between machines? So one abstraction is this mailbox idea. So that every machine has a mailbox, we can send something to someone else's mailbox and they can receive from their mailbox. And it goes through the network, and because we've tagged the message with the name of its of who it's going to, with the address presumably, that the network knows how to get it there. And we're also going to have queues of messages we're waiting to send. So we'll have our outgoing mailbox conceptually. You can say that this is the sort of outgoing mailbox. And we have a queue of messages not yet received, which is our incoming mailbox. And the network is our letter carrier who knows how to get it to our particular mailbox from their other mailbox. And this, you know, was a reasonable approximation of the sort of basic functionality provided by a network on top of which we build everything else. So what we want to build, let's say, the client-server model, and we're missing some things that we want to do on this. So what's an important thing when a client sends a message to a server? What's something that we need to have in that message? Would be useful to have. So like say I'm getting a web page. So I send a message to the server. So I'm sending not hello, but I'm sending to B, my web server. Get, you know, the 4414 web page. Is that going to be enough? Yeah.
The source of the server knows
Yeah, so we need a return address. The server needs to know how to send back to us, so I need to tag it with what I want, so I need a return address. And another thing I might need is I might have multiple related messages, like maybe I can't fit what I want in one letter, so I might need to have some way of combining multiple related messages. So we're going to have an abstraction that takes care of this. So we're going to have this abstraction called a connection, which is the idea is that we're going to build on top of this mailbox model, but we're going to keep track of this return address, and we're going to allow us to have a series of related messages so we can have sort of a conversation. So we're going to have two extra operations for this, and we're going to have this sort of connection object. So rather than just sending messages to a particular person, we're going to establish a connection by machine A connects, machine B accepts that connection, and they get this connection object that they can send and receive with, and they can do this more times than I'm showing here, so we can have A send another request now that it's established the connection. The idea here is that B is a server here, A connects to B, B accepts the connection, A learns that that was successful, that the server was actually where it expected. A can send a request to B, and now B can respond to that request. And because it's associated with this connection, A can just receive from that connection, and this abstraction handles the details of sending the actual return address with our data. And connections that we'll talk about have other things they handle which don't show up on this picture. So one of them is handling errors. So what if a letter gets lost in the mail? We have to handle that. That's something that we can have this abstraction deal with for us. So we'll have some way of saying, oh, I tried to send something and I didn't get a response. What is that means? I should try to send it again. That's going to be handled by this abstraction. What if we have more data than we can fit in one message? That's going to be handled by this abstraction. And if you want the details of how that works, take networking. I'm trying to not duplicate the entire contents of networking in this class because it's a separate class for a reason. So we're just going to say we have a connection, and the way it's going to work is it's going to be a two-direction pipe. So it's going to work exactly like a pipe, and in fact, in POSIX, it's going to have the exact same API that we're going to get a file descriptor to represent our connection, and we can use read and write on that file descriptor just like it was a pipe. And it's going to work exactly the same way. So that's what we're going to pick up next time when we'll talk about sockets, which is what these two-direction pipes are called.